So just a word about, in the round, about listening or discussing or reading the Buddha's teaching. It's impossible to get it all at once. It's just not possible. There's just way too much. Too many facets to it to conclusively sum it up in a way that somebody will just go, oh yeah, of course. I always assumed that if I'd walked out of a Dhamma talk having retained one piece of information, I was doing exceedingly well. And that it's, so it's repeated exposure to the Buddha's teaching, allied to real practice of mindfulness and the investigation of experience. Those two combined, gradually all the drawstrings come together and the little bits start to form a whole, and it all comes together. So it's completely understandable that, especially early on, there's quite a bit of head scratching and trying to put it all together. And I think perhaps this is another opportunity to practice patience and to have some faith and confidence that with time and application, those drawstrings will begin to come together, and all the different aspects of the teaching will start to make a whole for you. That's not what I wanted to talk about tonight, but it's all connected in one way or another. So I don't know if you've had the experience in a meditation of battling away, trying to get the mind under control, and then for no apparent reason everything goes quiet, calm. The last you knew, you were doing a hindrance, some defilement like central desire, and then suddenly you're right here, bang in the moment, aware, alert, and there's a sense of peace and calm. It doesn't necessarily have to be an extraordinary state of mind, but it's balanced. It might feel, the tranquility might be such that it feels like the town has suddenly gone on holiday and everyone's down tools and gone out and sat by the river for the rest of the day or something. It can happen quite unexpectedly. Sometimes it can happen, and this has been my experience, that it seems to happen towards the end of a meditation, like within the last 5 minutes, and then you think, for goodness sake, don't ring the bell, or whatever. Having spent 25 minutes or 55 minutes going, when will that bell ring? And then suddenly it's, oh, please don't ring the bell. What's happening there? Well, perhaps our internal clock has been working, and we are aware that perhaps now the end of the meditation is nigh, and somewhere in our unconscious it means we've accepted that there's no point trying anymore. So we stop trying to manipulate the meditation, we stop trying to control it. And the instant we do that, what happens? It all goes lovely and calm. And you think, my goodness, this is exactly what I wanted meditation to be. And what you have there is, well, it's free, what we call freedom from the hindrances. It can also be called momentary concentration or weak access concentration. It can also be called sobhanacitta in the Pali. Sobhana means beautiful. Citta means consciousness. So it's a beautiful state of consciousness, beautiful state of mind. And so what I thought I'd talk about for a little while is how to craft that beautiful state of mind. How to get it so that it arises more as a default rather than an Easter egg or a Christmas present or some rare event. How can we make sure that it's something that comes about regularly for us? And so really to cultivate and craft a beautiful state of mind, you have to employ the whole of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddhist training is threefold. There's the training in ethics, sila, the training in mental development, samadhi, and the training in wisdom, panya. So you train all three together. It's not like you train in ethics, and once you have achieved perfection in ethics, then you go and train the mind in mental development. And then once that's accomplished, then you develop wisdom. You have to develop wisdom in order to undertake the practice of living an ethical life. You have to undertake an ethical life in order to help develop the mind and calm the mind down. You need a calm mind in order to develop wisdom. So all the three trainings condition one another. So, but the very act of sitting down to meditate is training in the Noble Eightfold Path. It is training in these three trainings. So you might imagine the Buddha sitting in meditation, forming a triangle, and you've got ethics as your foundation. You've got the middle part, which is the development of the mind, in order to then, as the topmost part of the pyramid, developing wisdom that cuts through the appearance of things and shows you the way life really is. And so a beautiful state of mind is that mind which is capable of that deep insight. It's capable of that deep insight into the true nature of life because it's happy, it's calm, it's peaceful, it's balanced, it's compassionate, it's friendly. And what it lacks are defilements. So there's no greed, there's no passion, there's no lust, there's no hatred, no irritation, no boredom, no anxiety, no fear. You know, the whole rag bag of ills that we would all rather be without. And I deeply suspect that this is what every meditator wants. This is what brings us to meditate. We want to experience that beautiful state of mind, that beautiful consciousness. And it can be a bit of a shock to discover quite how much is involved in order to actually achieve it. But regular daily meditation is an absolute integral to this whole process. And I think from the very get-go, it's helpful to recognise that what we're doing is crafting the best possible supporting conditions to allow a beautiful state of mind to arise, as opposed to trying to force the mind into a beautiful shape. You cannot force the arising of a beautiful state of mind. That's a total contradiction in terms. If you're forcing, what you create is a forced mind, which is tight, tense, and doesn't have any of these beautiful qualities of which I speak. What we do is do our best to weave together the most appropriate supporting conditions to make it most likely that a beautiful state of mind will emerge. Okay. So there are so many things that we have to bear in mind, and I don't expect everyone to remember all of these. This is something that develops over a long period of time, but we have to start away from meditation. We have to start before you've even gone to sit in a chair. For instance, if you hold strong views, if you hold extreme views, and you hold them tightly and passionately, then it's very much recommended that you just loosen up. Just loosen up the tenacity with which you hold those views, whether it's views about the way the world is, or the way your friends are, or your family is, or the way that you are. It's highly recommended that you just let go of the intensity with which you hold on to views. Given that we're drawn to the Buddha's teaching because we wish to find out the true nature of life for ourselves and set ourselves free from suffering, contained within that is the recognition that we don't actually already know. Because if we already knew, we wouldn't have to go through this process. So all the views that we formed before coming to this teaching are based in not understanding the way life works. So at the very least, just holding our views lightly in our hands and being willing to accept that the world around us may very well disagree with us and disagree with the way that we see life will be of immense value to you when it comes to developing a beautiful state of mind. Because if you're riven with extreme views, It means that you perceive life around you as extremely divisive and contradictory and contrary, and so you then attempt to go and sit in a chair to meditate, and what's your mind full of? It's full of these conflicting ideas and values. So, and it's the first glimmerings of another quality they need walking this path, which is genuine humility. The humility to recognize that we don't know, and therefore we're entering into the spirit of the Buddha's teaching with a mind that does not know and is therefore open to inquiry, is open to new information, and that's a very critical thing to bear in mind. And that feeds then into living an ethical life, because if you hold extreme views, then you'll always come up against people who hold opposing views, and then there's the likelihood of division and the consequent conflict. In terms of living an ethical life, we live an ethical life, we keep precepts, we try to be kind and be of service to others, to become as harmless to others and ourselves as we can. There's no perfection in it. Perfection is going into the extremes. Remember that the Buddha's teaching is a middle way. It's neither too much of this nor too much of that. It's being flexible, being open, being adaptable. One does the best one can to keep precepts, to be as harmless to living beings as one can. And again, that's really important for when it comes to sitting down in a chair with your eyes closed. If you know that in the time that you've been practicing meditation, whether it's a week, a month, a year, 10 years, or a lifetime, you can sit there and be content in your own skin and say, well, yeah, I've made mistakes, but I haven't got anything really anyone could blame me for terribly. It means you are far more likely to be able to sit content and meditate. And it's therefore far more likely that a beautiful state of mind will emerge, because you haven't got anything for which you would feel any undue guilt. So you're a lot more comfortable in your own skin. And as I'm saying this, there's something beginning to percolate out of this, which is a common theme, whether we're talking about holding views and extreme views or living ethically, and our ability to sit in meditation. It all really boils down to self-view and our willingness to let go of the tenacity with which we are concerned with ourselves. So keeping precepts, for instance, is done out of a genuine concern for both ourselves and others, but not an overweening, neurotic self-obsession, obsession with oneself. If I could put it as clearly as I could, what it is that gets in the way of a beautiful state of mind arising, it is neurotic preoccupation with oneself. That is the one thing that will stop a beautiful state of mind from arising. The act of loosening up views, the act of trying to live as harmless life as possible, is all part of this process of giving up this neurotic preoccupation with oneself. We sit down to meditate, knowing that we've been as harmless in the world as we possibly can, and we, as best we can. And so we sit with our eyes closed, and unless it's beginner's luck, or it just happens to be the last 5 minutes of a meditation, rather than experiencing the bliss of a beautiful state of mind, what we tend to experience is lots and lots of thinking. And the mind just going off here, the mind just going off there. And it's like the whole world invades. And so we have to learn mental development. We have to learn what's happening, why it's happening, and how to bring it under control. Now, in the time available, I'm very limited, so I can only really choose one particular angle to look at. And this evening, and I was mulling on the Buddhist techniques, the four meditations that are called the Brahma Vihara. Brahmavihara means divine abiding. So there are four attitudes, four mental qualities that you can develop. The four are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy at the success of others, and equanimity. And the development of any one of them develops all four. So if you develop friendliness, loving kindness, you develop all four Brahmavihara. And what you are developing is a divine abiding. Vihara means temple, a Buddhist temple. And Brahma means godly, so a heavenly temple. So what are we doing when we practice the Brahmavihara? We're creating a mind which is like a heavenly temple, or a so it's a divine space. And that's what a beautiful state of mind is. It's just that lovely state of mind which is full of peace and happiness and contentment and wisdom and compassion and all these lovely things that we want our minds to be full of, right? Okay, so you can develop, you can practice, you can develop the technique of metta, loving kindness, and it will produce this lovely state of mind. But what is it that gets in the way? It's all this thinking. How well am I doing? Do I have enough stuff? Why won't she love me? Why, you know, it's just everything connected with you, everything that you think is wrong, everything that you think is out of place. It is all this passionate craving for life to be different than it is. What is it that we do when we practice Brahmavihara? We place all our emphasis on somebody else in order to benefit them. Now, that somebody else might also include you, but it's looking at you from a different perspective. It's not looking at you from the perspective of why is everything wrong, what's the matter with me, what's the matter with other people, why won't life conform to my wishes. When we practice this Brahmavihara, even towards ourselves, what we are practicing is looking at, especially with metta, what we're looking at is somebody's good qualities. So you're doing the opposite of that neurotic preoccupation. You're expending energy, you're acting generously on the mental level towards somebody, thinking about their good qualities, or thinking about the truth of their suffering, or delighting in their successes. Yeah. So it's spending time developing the mind towards a very efficient, very wholesome attitude of seeing the good in other beings. And so as a consequence of that, you can overcome the thinking, which is all about me, 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 and what's wrong with me, by developing this technique of generously using your mental energy to think about other people in positive ways. Okay, that's a beautiful thing to do. But what happens in practice is, you sit down, say at the beginning of your meditation, right, I'll do 10 minutes of metta, loving kindness, and through doing so, I'll generate the right conditions for this beautiful state of mind to emerge. I'll get lovely and concentrated, put all these hindrances aside because they'll all be done away with, and then I'll be able to really concentrate the mind, get really deeply into that lovely state. Fantastic. Okay. It doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work like that because of the thinking, the hindrances, very quickly asserts itself and sends you off in a weird direction. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, why? Why do we allow it? Why, when we sit down to meditate, do we allow something to get in the way with what we had chosen to do? Because that's often what happens with metta. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, what would happen if we were sitting down to organise a dinner party? Would you sit down with a piece of paper at a table and sit there and think, right, okay, got to organise this dinner party. How many people are coming along? Have they all been invited? Okay. So what do I need? We're just about to find out how little I know about organising dinner parties. Napkins? Napkins, definitely. Napkins. You get those sticks, don't you, with the little pineapple cubes and the cheese cubes on? Right, so pineapple cubes, cheese cubes, sticks, napkins. Right, and then you're doing that, and then you suddenly go, oh, I wonder what's under there. And you just sort of wander off. Oh, what's this? So, a bit too much acting going on. But you don't, do you? How many people just forget that they were organising a dinner party and just going there at a wall or something? Nobody does that. Why do we do that in meditation? Why is it that we're... All right, I'm going to... Okay, all right, let's do some metta. And then before you know it, you're off with the fairies and just completely forgotten that you'd sat down. And the reason is because you hadn't such a clear sense of purpose as you do when you organise a dinner party. There's somebody who's done a lot of dinner party organising. So... Is this just a lack of sense of purpose and a lack of clear comprehension of what's unfolding when we meditate? So it takes time to learn this, but it's really helpful with meditation, a really helpful supporting condition, which is to work out what you're going to do before you do it and learn to stick to your guns. You will develop excellent levels of concentration by organising properly before you begin a session of metta, who you're going to do it towards, and for how long for each person, and then you stick to it. You get some discipline, and you learn. And so, when the mind wants to go off and wander off into its neurotic preoccupations, you know that that's not what you'd sat down to do, and so then you bring it back, and you stay on track. So as part of meditation, you have to understand that discipline is required. You do need to learn how to discipline the mind. But here's the thing with all of this, and you know because I've said it so many times, unless you're very new, in which case you will hear it many times, you have to always start from a position of acceptance. When you sit down to meditate, the mind will go off and do what it normally does. And you have to be willing to accept your dark side, your difficult side, your neurotic side. It's all part of the process of eventually having mastery of the mind and being able to experience a beautiful state of mind more often than not, and get to the point where it actually becomes your default setting. So you can't do it. I know it's paradoxical. You think, well, I want a lovely, beautiful state of mind. So what Paul's saying is the way I get a beautiful state of mind is by becoming more aware of defilements. But it is. You become more aware, you include more and more of what's really going on in the meditation and in your life. You include it in what you note. Because there's this beautiful payoff, which is because you're willing to accept the existence of a defilement, it means you're not setting up a war with it. You're not setting up a fight with it. You're allowing that irritability to be there so that you can truly see it for what it is. This is the not-so-secret of meditation. It's paradoxical because you think, well, if I just let these hindrances in, they will just take over my mind and I'll never experience a beautiful state of mind. But it's not like that, because there's a different quality there, and the quality is mindfulness and the clear comprehension that comes with that mindfulness. So you sat down to think about the good qualities of somebody, and then you started having naughty thoughts about them. Well, okay, that's fine. Just acknowledge what's arisen. Say, yeah, okay, that all right, that's a greedy thought. Okay, fine. Okay, that's just part of my nature. That's fine. And you acknowledge it. But then you go, right, okay, so let's get back to what I had intended to do. And because you're not going, oh, it's terrible, I'm supposed to be a spiritual person and I've got this terrible mental quality, you will never get calm. You will never experience a beautiful state of mind. So start from a position of acceptance, contentment, patience, all these sterling qualities that you develop, and keep coming back to what you had intended to do until you've done it. So with, say, something like the practice of metta, I would strongly urge you only to do it for a very short space of time, so you've got far more chance of succeeding with your volition. Do it for 5 minutes. Do it for 5 people. That's actually quite a lot. And it might actually take you longer, given that there's likely to be all these, a bit of a circuitous route before you actually complete each person. But complete each person. Think about their good qualities. Wish them well. And then move on to the next person. It doesn't have to be every single good quality that they possess. But what I would say is, spend more time in developing the connection with the person by thinking about their good qualities than you do wishing them well. That's more powerful. The better the connection, a bit like your internet, the better connection, the more powerful the effect. So, and you're not doing it to change the other person. You're not doing it to make them a good person because they're a terrible person and you want to make them good. That's not how it works. You develop it to change the culture of your own mind, to bring your own mind to this state of Brahma-vihara, of this divine temple, this divine abiding. And it is a very powerful practice, and it will produce this lovely peace and contentment. But you're not trying to force peace and contentment. What you're doing is generously giving your mental energy to somebody else and thinking about their good qualities and wishing them well. As a result, this beautiful state of mind emerges. It's like a rainbow. It's like if there's sunshine and rain, you get a rainbow. If there's no sunshine or no rain, you don't get a rainbow. It's conditions. And it's the same with beautiful states of mind. They're just arising because the most appropriate supporting conditions are there. So that is one very effective way of suppressing all that neurotic preoccupation. And what happens when you suppress that? That you're not allowing the mind to be overrun in that way, is that the obsessive thoughts lessen. It becomes more like you've got this really beautiful space, it's like a temple-like space. It's lovely and calm, peaceful. And every now and again, the winds of karma start raging, and you just got all this debris that comes into the temple complex through the windows and through the doors. And you just have to get your broom, and you just have to go and sweep them all out again. So there's this process of experiencing this lovely, peaceful state of mind, and then something coming in and infecting it, all of which has to be done with loving attention, interest, acceptance, allowing these thoughts to emerge, and then dealing with them once they have emerged and pushing them away again. The tendency is to think, right, I've got this lovely space now, I'm just going to keep everything out. Instantly you try to do that, instantly you try to grasp onto that beautiful state of mind, it will cease because you've started craving for life to be different in that instant. So this is craft, gradually developing the right spiritual attitudes, the right techniques in order for that beautiful state of mind to emerge. It's not, you can't just click your fingers and say, well, you will emerge. But if you persist, if you commit to generating as many of the conditions as you possibly can, which make it more likely for that state to emerge, it will emerge. Like the rainbow. If there's sunlight and rain, the rainbow appears. So as long as you keep putting in the conditions, you will get this lovely effect. You know when you've got that beautiful state of mind because you're going, oh wow, this is beautiful. Oh, this is lovely. This is what. Why isn't it always like this? It's like, has everyone else finished? Stark Myers, is anyone else in here? Because it just feels like everything's just gone. It's lovely and peaceful. Okay. And so it's so worthwhile spending the time learning how to do it. And the more you do it, and the more you enter into it, and to begin with, it'll feel like luck. But it's not luck. Because think of all the effort you've put in. You know, it's not just luck in that last 5 minutes of the meditation that everything went quiet. All the conditions were right. And so it emerged. And one of the most important conditions was you stopped trying to make it happen. And the moment you stop trying to make it happen, there it is. It's actually really, it is our natural state. Our natural state is to be calm, happy, friendly, peaceful. Now, the only drawback, well, it's not really a drawback, but if you just, from that position, you just repeatedly try to get more and more concentrated, you will get deeper and deeper into bliss and peace and extraordinary experiences. However, there's one drawback, and that drawback is that you can't make it stay. Eventually, no matter how long you set the alarm for, right, 9 hours, 9 hour meditation, right, here you go. After that 9 hours, you have to get up. At least you'll have to go for a pee. Maybe you even have to have something to eat. You can't get away with it. You can't. If it is a conditioned experience, because you carefully crafted the right supporting conditions, you get this lovely state emerging. But the thing is, with anything created, it breaks. Anything that arises passes away again. That's fundamental to the Buddha's teaching, and that's fundamental to the way life works. So you cannot rely on that beautiful state of mind that you have created through generating the right supporting conditions. So you have to go a further step. You have to reach a point where you are no longer reliant on anything for your happiness, where you are not emotionally cleaving to anything in time and space, any object, anything, any person, anything, for your happiness. And so, if you're successful in doing that, which is the whole point of the insight training, you emerge as this person who enjoys this lovely state of mind, but it's not conditioned. It's just your nature. It's just the natural state of a human being, to be friendly and kind and compassionate and free from psychological bondage of all kinds. And so that then is the real peace, because it's not created. It's not something that you've manufactured. It's what's left after you've stopped passionately wanting life to be different, and that passionately wanting life to be different is based in a false view, false understanding of life. And the mechanism by which you get from dependency on beautiful states of mind that you've created to this non-dependent happiness is, that's what insight wisdom is for. So from this place, meditative state of having developed this lovely sense of ease and peace and tranquility, the next stage is to undertake a focused, purposeful investigation of unfolding experience in order to look carefully at every component part of experience to see that it is all arising due to conditions. Everything is arising due to conditions and passing away. And there is no element in experience that lasts for more than the most fleeting moment. And so there is this dance, this rhythm of life. And when you get free of hindrances, when you get this beautiful state of mind, you start to appreciate that sounds are just arising by themselves, thoughts are just arising by themselves, states of consciousness are just arising by themselves, tickly coughs are just arising by themselves. It's just this lovely unfolding rhythm. And self-perpetuating, and you see that all these elements are just arising and passing away all by themselves. It's that deep insight that shows you that there is nothing that you need to cling on to for your happiness. That clinging on to anything for your happiness is the problem. Clinging on to the idea of happiness is the problem. And you just learn to let life go free. You just learn to just relax into life and let life be exactly what it is, and realize that it is absolutely fine, it's perfect, it's all unfolding, it's magical, it's mysterious, and you do not need to cleave to anything for that happiness. That happiness is what's left after all this passionate clinging to life has been let go of. To sum up, ethics, mental development, and wisdom. Keep utilizing this teaching in all aspects of your life. Keep developing the best possible supporting conditions to make the arising of these beautiful states of mind more likely. And then you utilize those beautiful states of mind to gain even deeper wisdom into the true nature of reality, and it's that that ultimately sets you free. Before the evening started, I was on the patio out back at number 8, trying to work out what to talk about, and then thinking just stopped because I was just taking in what was happening all around me. I think we have a few artists that come along to the centre. I dabble, so whatever degree, but it's like, why bother? It's like life every moment is giving you a Picasso. There's abstract, there's representative, there's your universe is just throwing up these incredible artistic displays every moment, and it's singing to you. Life is singing to you every moment. There's a rhythm, a dance going on every moment. Blackbirds singing, and the whoosh of cars going up and down the road. And it's like, because we're so preoccupied with trying to get somewhere and become something, we've kind of totally lost touch with the rhythm and the singing, universe singing to us that's going on all the time. And so the more and more you step away from the neurotic preoccupation, and more you settle into beautiful states of mind which are free of that, and you then can start taking in the true wonder and the true mystery that's unfolding each and every moment. And you wonder, as a consequence, how could I ever have missed this? How ever could I have not have noticed? You know, it's like, oh my God, it's like, and you keep revisiting that post-training, and it's always new. You're always suddenly, you're just like suddenly amazed at, oh, and it's like you never get bored of it because it's amazing. This is amazing. The fact that this is happening is astounding, but everyone takes it so for granted because they're so caught up in their vortex of, you know, self-concern.